Hi there, welcome back to the TV podcast. We have reached the penultimate episode of season one of HBO's Perry Mason. I am again your host, Devin Higgins, and I'm joined by two guests this week. Coming back from last week is my buddy James Farner. James, welcome back.
Hi, great to be back. I had so much fun last week that I thought I would bring along a special friend.
It's funny because in all the years I've been doing this for The Incomparable, I have yet to have a female guest on my show. And because this is such a diverse cast and such a big story, I wanted to get a female perspective on it. So who better than to bring in than making her Incomparable debut, Miss Taylor Hickney. Taylor, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here, and I've been listening along with James to all of your other episodes, so I'm excited and ready.
So, Taylor, before we really dive into this, and again, it's an hour and we got a lot to cover here, but if you can, just kind of give me a little bit of background. I understand from James that your dad was a big Perry Mason fan of the original series back in the day, but have you been kind of watching this through self-defense or by proxy, or what's been your angle of approach to get into this one?
Well, it wasn't my idea. My dad watched the old one. We happened to be down at my parents' house because of everything going on. And James suggested that we watch it. And then my dad jumped on board. And I usually like to give a show at least an episode, like, you know, to see if I like it. And I did. So now I'm here.
So through the first six chapters, and of course we're rolling into chapter seven here with one more to go, if you can just kind of encapsulate what's been your interpretation of it, how's your reaction to it been so far?
I like it. I do. I think it's pretty smart and well written. It's not without, I think, like, there are some little things I have questions about, and I don't think maybe this is just me, but I didn't see it going in the direction of the church, what is it, the Radiant Assembly of God, that I wasn't expecting that, and so I appreciate that element to it.
Okay. Well, without further ado, I'm going to dive into the flash cast of this one, and it starts not as we expected the way chapter 6 to end last week, but it begins with a flashback to Sister Alice as a child with her and her mother stranded on an open road. A man stops and offers to help, but only if he can have his way with Sister Alice in return. We flash forward to Perry at the doorstep of Jim Hicks, who we met at the end of the last chapter. We find out that Hicks was the church's previous accountant and reluctantly participated in financial collusion between George Gannon, Herman Baggerly, and church deacon Eric Seidel. Mason presents Hicks's financial records, proving the church was $100,000 in debt, the same amount demanded as the ransom for the return of Charlie Dodson, way back in chapter one. The plot thickens. Pete Strickland tails an anxious Seidel in hopes of getting him to testify, but is given the slip. And after telling Perry this, the two argue, and Pete says he is but done, both with the case and as Perry's friend. Seidel goes to Detective Innes for help, only to have Innes murder him instead, but after the two men reveal that they both had a hand in Charlie Dodson's murder. Meanwhile, Sister Alice talks with Emily Dodson about her plans to bring Charlie back on Easter Sunday, then is confronted by a mob led by Elder Brown at the radio station, where he brings in the man she supposedly healed and proclaims her as a fraud before cutting off her microphone. Paul Drake is brought back in, and he begins his own investigation into the dead kidnappers, discovering yet another connection to Detective Innes. He and Perry go to the brothel Innes skims from, where Mason learns that Innes was accompanied by a now-dead prostitute. He theorizes nursing from a heavily drugged woman would be deadly to the baby, which coroner Virgil Sheets confirms, and then the next day on Easter, the resurrection ceremony goes exactly as planned. It's a disaster, as Charlie Dodson's casket is empty. Alice's mother, Bertie, travels with her to a different location where she finds a different baby and claims it to be Charlie, but an increasingly disillusioned Sister Alice flees from the scene, and that is where we end chapter 7, leading into the finale next week. Now, we should dive in at this point and break down what we have, but James, I know that this one wasn't a particularly strong episode for you, and I'll give you first crack to elaborate as to why.
Yeah, and I actually watched it twice, and the second time through, I will say that I enjoyed it more, but that first time through in particular, it was not my favorite, probably a bottom one or two episode of the season for me, and I think in part that's because it was not what I was expecting from a penultimate episode. And we had some discussion that over the years, HBO in particular has trained their audiences to expect certain things from a penultimate episode in a season. That it would be a really big episode with either lots of important plot developments or often big character deaths or big other set piece scenes. And this goes as far back as at least The Wire. But it certainly, Game of Thrones was very famous for their penultimate episodes having big impacts, and everything up through Watchmen and The Outsider have all had big penultimate episodes. At least for me, I didn't find this episode to be particularly stand out in that regard, and with only 2 hours left, I was expecting something a little bit bigger. With, as you know, we'll touch on Pete survives. There's no big death scene with him. There are a few bigger plot revelations that do occur, and some of that is what I appreciated a little bit more on the second watch through. But the first time through in particular, it was a little bit of a letdown to me.
Taylor, what about you?
I tend to be a little bit more trusting of TV shows, I think, than James. I'm pretty good at suspending my disbelief. And I mean, it goes both ways, because sometimes I may not be able to realize where a show is actually airing when I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt to see what comes next. But I kind of took it this episode. I didn't dislike it, and I definitely liked it more the second time through. But I just kind of figure I chalk it up to something big is going to happen in the next one. Obviously, it's the finale, and they need to get the groundwork laid. I actually thought it was pretty good as far as clarifying points go. There were things that we weren't sure of, or at least that hadn't been officially said yet. And I feel like now we definitely have that confirmation. So, you know, I liked it.
I do agree with you in. And I've been using this analogy throughout these shows that we've been doing of, if you think about it in terms of a roller coaster, you have that ratcheting up to about the midway point in the season, then you get that first big drop. And because this is such a condensed first season, they don't have the writers much time to really elaborate and expound on a lot of stuff. They've got to keep it really lean, really tight. So you don't have as many twists and turns and dips as you would if this was even a 13 or 14 episode series like you would see with things like Game of Thrones. This was more of a smaller dip. And I do agree with you, Taylor, in that they needed to start really putting all the pieces into place to set up for the season finale. And anybody who is familiar with Perry Mason or even these types of stories, we know Perry's going to win the case. Emily's going to get off. And things are going to be as bright and rosy as they can be, given the circumstances from where we started to where we ended. That said, there are pieces of this episode that I didn't like nearly as much as with others. And it starts right out the gate with the flashback to Sister Alice and her mom, as presumably they're on their way to L.A. And it looks like it was maybe 20 years ago. And it's one thing to have a busted down car and trying to find a way to get help, but seeing the quick twist that that takes, using the abuse angle trope didn't sit well with me. And I guess part of it is that I've seen it done so many times in different series over the years that it seems overused. How did you guys respond to that?
Well, the thing, I agree with you about the trope of abuse. I'm a writer, and so I agree with you in general. The jury's still out for me on whether they were using that trope as just an easy way to explain her confusion and disillusionment. I think, you know, abuse is never done well, but in a TV show or in a movie, if it's done well and authentically, usually it's not like the only reason, or that the character that was abused earlier in their life is suffering. And I actually don't think that this hinges on that. I think it's an incredibly important part of how Alice got to where she is today, but I am not sure that that is the driving force of hers anymore, which is why I am more willing to accept the abuse trope.
James, what about you?
I think that I feel pretty similarly to the two of you. There's not a ton of indication in Alice's character up through now in the season that abuse figured heavily into her history. So it did seem a little bit like shorthand for Alice has had a rough history. She's a very broken person. She has a very unhealthy relationship with her mother. And those things are all things that come back in this episode that we see in Alice, and that lead to her decision at the end of the episode. What we don't see is anything more substantially connected to actual abuse, to bring it back, which is where I lean towards you a little bit, that if the only point of showing the abuse is to be a shortcut towards these other traits, I'm not sure that that sits super comfortably with me. But if we come back next episode and everything is blowing up between Alice and her mother, and these things come back to have heavier repercussions and more thoroughly dealt with, then I think I'll sit with it a little better.
Yeah. And I think back to, I think it was chapter 6. Yeah, where she and her mother are having that argument and Birdie slaps her.
Right.
And Sister Alice looks at her and says, "I'm remembering a lot of stuff, Mama."
That's true.
And to be crystal clear on this, I'm not suggesting in any way that having this sort of background either diminishes Sister Alice as a character or something that should be considered marginalized or trivialized in some way. To the opposite, especially now with what has happened culturally in the last few years and how much abuse has really come to the fore sociopolitically and rightly so. What irks me is just the idea of throwing that in there as a nugget of character development without giving it the weight that I guess we expect it should have. And that was the one thing that bothered me. It was like, don't put it in there just to be a semi-arbitrary thing, because it's not. It absolutely isn't, nor should it be treated that way.
I completely agree. And I think what we're saying, what we're all three kind of saying in different ways, is that it's not implicated enough, which basically means that if you can take, you know, one piece of the character development out, and the whole, or not necessarily character development, but if you can take a piece of the plot out, or like a big tenet of it, then, and the whole thing doesn't fall apart, then it's not implicated. And it is, I think that's what we're saying, that it doesn't come through for us as like truly authentic yet.
And as somebody who's done writing myself, and I'm working on a story around a central character who is dealing with similar trauma, it's not of this exact nature, but when you go through that, it's important to understand and give it the proper weight. And that was always something that my writing teachers always told me about, was if you can't justify why it's there in a realistic way, then it doesn't need to be there.
Exactly.
And if you think back to the time period especially, this definitely was not uncommon. And the problem was it was unspoken. And we see how Sister Alice didn't necessarily deal with it in what we would now, in our more advanced thinking, would maybe consider a healthy way. Because, again, it wasn't dealt with that way 90 years ago. We're seeing in some ways the impact of it, but as far as the relationship with her mother. And I think she's finally getting a full grasp of how toxic that dynamic is. Transitioning from that, we do have, as James alluded to, some good news in this, and that Pete's not dead.
Unbelievable.
The crazy thing was, is that I, on the one hand, I wanted to be kind of upset about that, but on the other, I think it was my own semi-warped expectations of, well, why can't Pete just realize that he's had enough?
I think similarly to what we were saying before, my feelings on this depend on what they do with it going forward. If that truly was the last scene of Pete for this season, for the show entirely, I will be pretty disappointed, because that's a very anticlimactic way to let a very big member of this cast and this show go out. And if next episode he comes back and heroically dies, or if he comes back and helps out with the case for one last piece of important evidence before he steps away, or maybe if he comes back to help out again next season, those are all things that would make me feel a little better about this choice and a little less cheated of a strong ending for Pete.
Completely agree.
Because everything had been leading to the high probability that Pete wasn't going to survive the season, and again, it's a case of knowing a red herring versus knowing a breadcrumb. The writers had done a really good job of laying breadcrumbs down by what happened with EB and just kind of the brutality of the world that Pete and Perry were occupying, and also that Paul Drake was coming more into the fore as a member of this potential new triumvirate, that somebody had to be the odd man out, and the person looking to be the odd man out was Pete. That it didn't go that way, I found it on the one hand refreshing, and on the other hand, in a weird way, morosely disappointing. Even though it was like, it's like, I'm so glad Pete is not dead, because again, Shea Whigham had another great episode. That standoff with him and Perry back at the farm was great, because, and he's so understated in the way he plays Pete Strickland. I want to see him come back. And yeah, James, I agree with you. I'd like to see him get a little bit more of a dignified exit than him just kind of saying he's done. But also at the same time, as a character, that seems very much like Pete. To just say, that's it. Okay, I'm done. Bring in the new guy. I'm out.
Oh, I don't know. It doesn't. If that were to be his last scene, I would not feel good about that. I've decided.
No, I don't think they can. They can't leave it as a dangling participle.
No.
You know, we need to get a little bit more closure, especially because Pete doesn't, based on the conversation at the time, he didn't know the full background of why Perry was so pissed off.
Right.
That's true.
This is somewhat cliched as well, but I think once the case has been resolved, the verdict's been read, we get to the denouement, having that moment with Pete and Perry where cooler heads can prevail, and even if they decide to go their own ways, at least we get that closure.
Yeah, that would be nice for them to add in.
I know, James, you and I had talked about how last week, especially with Sister Alice, what a tightrope she was walking.
Yes.
Leading into this week. And I remember I said how it wouldn't take much for her to lose her audience. She lost it.
Well, I guess what do you mean by losing her audience? Because I think the scandal of it all could attract just as many people.
It absolutely could. That was another element of this episode that kind of came out of the blue. But again, I knew it was on the horizon of when they're at the radio station and Elder Brown and his mob storm in. You see him looming over Sister Alice. And again, it plays to the way that this series has been shot and the cinematography and the blocking of it. And it goes back to, I believe, Chapter 5, where she was addressing the crowd surrounded by the elders and we couldn't hear her. until she came to the front.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
The staging of that is still one of my favorite parts of this season. And in this particular exchange, you have Elder Brown, the way they shot up at him as he's looming over Sister Alice and she's sitting at the table. She even looks tinier behind that microphone as he's there basically calling her out as a fraud. And they bring in the guy who was at the healing ceremony. She tries to get her voice back and kind of ease everybody else around, and they cut the mic. And the last thing we see in that scene is her arguing with Elder Brown, but we're not hearing her because the mic has been cut.
I thought that specific scene was really interesting because, I guess in my opinion, and, you know, I grew up ensconced in religion, and I'm not anymore, but that is neither here nor there. And the first thing that occurred to me would be, why wouldn't she, like, right immediately know to say, like, ye of little faith, like something like that, because to me that just seems like a no-brainer, and it seemed to take her a little bit to get there. And, you know, she said it and then she faltered and then she had to repeat it again. Yeah, so I found it interesting for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, she does try and throw the words back at Elder Brown, but at this point, he's become such a zealot of his own for his own purely selfish reasons and his own, I don't want to say megalomaniacal reasons, but his own quest to get his power back,
yeah,
that Sister Alice was able to take from him. He just doesn't care. He's going to bulldoze through everything she says and everything she does, because he's on his own mission and he feels like he is the righteous man who's going to get the church back the way he wants it.
It does feel like there is a small vein of sexism running there from the elders to Sister Alice and her mom. Like, they never take them seriously, like, practically anything they say.
I don't think it's that small of a vein.
Okay.
No, I would agree with that.
Didn't want to say something groundbreaking.
We've seen that throughout this first season of just how patriarchal and misogynistic and authoritative the elders are. They're silver-haired, middle-aged white men who run this church. And as we're finding out in this episode, most of them are frauds.
Right.
But rather than do anything to threaten their own positions of authority, they would rather take the figurehead that they built up, tear her down, and be like, come in and go, we're the ones who are going to save the church. We're the ones who are going to save all of you, because we're the ones who are going to tell you what you need. We're the ones who are going to tell you what you want. And we're the ones who are going to reap the benefits of doing this without them understanding the full extent of just what it is they're doing.
That doesn't sound like our country at all, does it?
No, of course not. What? Modern parallels. Can't have that sort of stuff in a period drama. We're purists here. So we ended chapter 6 on a cliffhanger as Perry is at the door of a house in the middle of nowhere with a man with a rifle. And we find out that Jim Hicks isn't what he's necessarily cracked up to be either. And the first thing Hicks asks him is, are you scared of me? And Perry's like, well, I'm not sure what to make of you. And he just tosses Perry his rifle and goes, okay, you see a coyote, shoot it.
I feel pretty good claiming about 75% accuracy in my prediction last week on what Jim Hicks would turn out to be. I didn't quite have his motivations down, but he was more or less what I expected.
I like the exchange between the two of them where they both understand and acknowledge that they are very imperfect people and that they both understand that they have an opportunity to right some wrongs here. Granted, the way Perry's going about it is completely different than what Hicks is trying to do.
Right.
There is some solace in the rationale of dealing with equally infallible people. And knowing that there's a way that if you guys can figure out how to get out of the situation, a rising tide does lift all boats.
I do think it's interesting that Hicks goes out of his way to mention that, Sister Alice changed his life. And he very specifically says that he will not say a word against her.
As
in
if Perry asked him to.
Yeah, and we don't get a whole lot of further development on that. But at the same time, when you come across people who don't necessarily offer you salvation, but make your life a little bit better. Yeah, it is hard to sit there and think, well, I don't want to bring her down. If I need to bring down everything around her and keep her standing, Hicks is willing to make that concession. To me, that, you know, I don't see any flaw in his logic by doing that, especially when he gets to court and fully unveils the grand scope of the conspiracy that Perry is dealing with in regards to what's happening with the church. It's like, okay, if you have Elder Brown trying to attack Sister Alice from one angle, and now you have Jim Hicks coming around with what he knows, I am curious to see how that will ultimately resolve for the church next episode.
Or if it will. I wouldn't be surprised if the Radiant Assembly of God falls to pieces after, I mean, this season. Depends on what happens next week. But God, they're all so corrupt in that church.
Once we get Hicks on the stand and we start to hear his side of it, and Perry, we see him starting to grow more as a litigator and as an attorney in how he's able to get what he needs from his witnesses, even though D.A. Barnes, still played by the excellent Stephen Root, is trying to find ways to trip him up and keep him from getting the information to the jury. He can't let Perry have any foothold on anything that's going to undermine what he's trying to convince the jury, that it's all Emily Dodson, you need to convict her so we can hang her, and that's it. Put a period on it. Done.
Yeah, he has, Barnes, that is, has one very classic Barnes moment this episode where he says to the judge and the jury of the room at large, you know, I still don't see what the church's finances has to do with the murder of Charlie Dodson. And as he says that, he holds up the picture of the dead baby and shows it to the jury. But
still creeps me out.
Yeah, but as you said, Perry is getting sharper by the minute, and he throws it right back and says, I don't understand what that picture has to do with your complaint.
No. And when he gets up to cross-examine Hicks, and he's just keeping right on the Emily Dodson railway, it's, did you know her? No. Do you have any interactions with her? No. So as far as you know, everything you're telling us is so outlandish and has no bearing on this at all. And then Hicks goes, well, I got the books.
His face is incredible.
I almost expected, the soundtrack and the music in this series has been pretty subtle and underplayed, as you would expect in a 1930s noir detective story.
Right.
I genuinely expected to hear the trumpeter, like, blow a wrong note. Almost like a...
like a record scratch.
Yeah, literally.
Exactly.
You must be wondering how I got in this situation, or whatever that meme is.
And when Perry looks at Della, Della looks back and looks at Hazel, and Hazel, the smile on Hazel's face as she's bringing that big bag with the books up.
Love it.
It was priceless to me. It was one of those where she's just like, I'm having a ball here.
Yep.
And you've got Ham Burger in there too, sitting right behind them, and he's also very interested in watching them take down Barnes.
The smirks he was giving sitting behind her, especially as Hazel walks by, and he's like, I should be able to move into that office by June. Taylor, one of the things, again, why I was really interested in having a female voice on this show, one of the things that has really stood out to me has been the emergence of the female characters that we've had so far in people like Della and Hazel. To you, especially from your background as a writer, what's been your take on that so far?
Well, I am also bisexual, so I really love to see the queer representation between Hazel. It's Hazel and Della. And that their relationship seems really good. I love that it's queer representation that is not, like, related to queer phobia of any kind. Because she's very much in the closet to everybody but Ham Burger, it seems like, and Hazel, and maybe the people of that house. And I just, it's nice to see that, and then Della's conversation with Ham, that's even more representation, and I like that they have that little thing, that little special relationship going where he says, you're the only person in this town I can be honest with, because I'm sure that's absolutely true. You know, the 1930s didn't look too kindly on LGBTQ plus people. And as far as the women representation goes, I'm always wanting more female characters. And so I love Della, and I would love to see her have more screen time. And I have a feeling in season two, we will. Yeah, so I think, you know, they've done a pretty good job. There are a whole lot of white men in this show, but I think that's kind of the point.
The one thing that I do appreciate as well is that by having the representation as it is, having Ham be a gay character, having Della be gay, you know, it's also not used for purely salacious purposes, which being an HBO show.
Exactly.
They could have very much gone that way. We saw this, granted, we're leaping genres considerably here, but, you know, that was the knock on Game of Thrones for so long, was that utilizing relationships of all sorts just to be able to get people naked and have that to, you know, appease one portion of the audience. Okay, fine. They could have, if they wanted to, gone in a similar way with this, but I genuinely appreciate that the writers had the discipline and the restraint to not do that, but also conveying that Della and Ham and Hazel and everybody else, that they are a part of this Los Angeles.
100%. And it's like they just exist.
Yeah.
And I love that. I feel like you don't, I mean, more and more these days you see it, but in most of queer representation in history, in, you know, what you have at literature, TV, movies, it's about them being queer and whether, and them being either oppressed because of that or like coming out of the closet. And so, yeah, exactly what you said. I just like that it exists, and that's that. And it acknowledges that regardless of how many people were actually out in 1930s Los Angeles, that those people did exist and have always existed.
Going to your point about that scene with Della and Hamilton, you know, it wasn't a long scene. And again, they don't have time to really embellish and live in that stuff up. But there was so much character development in those little exchanges.
100%.
That when you had Hamilton, and to be fair, when we first met Berger, the breadcrumb was laid down there. There was just his whole demeanor and such was one where I was like, I'm pretty sure that Hamilton is a gay man. There was no relevance in bringing that up at the time because it was all about getting Perry to where he needed to be in order to pass the bar. So if they had done something frivolous at that point with Hamilton, it would have been completely wasted.
Right.
But here, with Della as an absolute kindred spirit and a counterpoint to him, you have two people of the exact same background dealing with the exact same stigma, the exact same prejudices, being able to have this conversation under the ruse of being a straight couple, which many people have had to do for decades, even before then and after that.
And what's even more interesting is that I was thinking about this today. 1930s means that women have only had the right to vote for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like, I think that is really interesting to think about. You know, that you said that two people from the exact same backgrounds and stuff like that. And that is almost true, except that a decade ago, Della wouldn't have even been able to vote.
Mm.
So when you think of it that way, yeah, I don't know. It makes more sense to maybe why she is the way that she is. She's a very spicy person, but also doesn't speak out of turn as often as she would like to, I think. And I'm sure that contributes to it.
And as we've been pointing out throughout this series, you know, Della has, her position has long had to be the voice of reason and to be the adult in the room.
Right.
I would like her to be able to grow and continue to grow further out of that as the series goes. But for this little episode, and again, she didn't have to do much heavy lifting in this one, which I'm fine with.
Right.
We gave her a chance in similar way to after the funeral for EB, and we got her backstory.
I agree.
We get to see now more of the full arc of where she's come. And I'll be honest, knowing how I expect this first season to end, I am really looking forward to seeing Hamilton Berger be more involved. And again, for people who remember the original series, Hamilton Berger was the DA that Perry squared off in the Raymond Burr 1950-60s series. So there is a definite precedent for him to come back and not have him be a one-shot potential token character, which I would really be disappointed if that ended up being his full involvement in the series as well.
I feel like there's no way. They've only laid, like, groundwork for him. I feel like they could do so much more. And hopefully they will.
Taking a similar vein from Game of Thrones, you remember that first season, you had Sean Bean and, you know, you had all these big names that were involved. And by the end of season one, they were done and gone in no small part because the producers knew we can't afford these people going forward.
Right.
So let's get them in, use them for what we need, and then we can usher them out at the end of the first season and let the core that we need take over going forward. I see no reason why Hamilton Berger is not involved in that plan.
Right. If you're saying that Barnes is the Ned Stark of the show, I, you know, have a little question there. But
maybe E.B. was the Ned Stark of the show.
Maybe that probably makes a lot more sense.
I'm just glad Pete wasn't the Ned Stark of the show, okay?
Amen.
And for anybody who's listening to this and hasn't watched Game of Thrones, one, shame on you. Go sit on the naughty step for a while and think about your life. And two, if you're not aware of that spoiler by now, that's on you.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, sorry. I think the statute of limitations on that one might be up.
Don't come crying to us about a show that started 10 years ago. By the way, have you ever seen Titanic? The boat sinks. I'm not giving anything away here.
Do you think at the end that it is going to be that Emily is exonerated and acquitted and that everything works out with a shiny, happy bow? I mean, that's what I would like to see, but that's like... would that be not great writing?
Jump it right to the end.
I think exonerated, yes. Shiny, happy bow, no.
Okay.
In this episode, we have seen just how much further Emily has deteriorated.
Oh, yeah.
I did like how, as Perry was talking with Hicks during his testimony, and he spies the jury looking over at Emily, and Emily has her nose in her Bible rather than paying attention to what's going on, that Perry catches it, grabs it, and gives them a way for everybody to focus back on what is happening. But Emily is just, she's been put through the ringer so much. And that exchange with her and Della, where she basically... she says, you know, come Sunday, everybody in this city is going to owe me an apology.
Oh, yeah.
And then it happens and we see just she's done. I don't see Emily Dodson having a happy ending. I see her being exonerated, that the case goes the way Perry wants it to go. But I don't see the damage that she has endured to this point as being anything but irreparable.
Oh, no way. I mean, I think just... right away, the loss of a child is irreparable damage, not to mention everything that came after that.
And we laid it out last week, and you're absolutely right, Taylor, of the emotional scars that she has got to this point, it would crack anybody. I cannot imagine anyone who would come out of this having some serious, serious stuff that they would need to work out. And in that way, it makes Emily a tragic character, even if, and odds are, when Perry is able to prove that she did not kill her son.
Right. Isn't the, you know, it's been a while since I studied the exact meaning of a tragic character, but maybe this is actually an ironic character, but it's when a tragic is like when all the bad things happen to them, but it's not their fault. Is sort of like this simpler, simplified version of what makes a tragic hero. And I definitely think Emily Dodson qualifies for that. I mean, if her only mistake was infidelity,
I would definitely put her in the category of irony. Her own infidelity aside, that was her major flaw.
Yep.
And that everything that has happened to her has to do completely with forces beyond her control.
Exactly.
And even Perry lays that out for her, saying, look, you have to admit at this point, the church does not have your best interest in mind. And Della even tries to talk some sense into her in that vein, but Emily just can't. She's so far gone that she can't see that.
I remember the scene when she is standing out and smoking with Sister Alice, and Sister Alice is, she's almost asking herself as well, as she's, you know, asking Emily to say it, say her doubt that she knows that she's feeling. And Emily finally says, "Are you lying to me?" And Alice says, "Nothing will be the same after tomorrow," or something like that.
Yep.
And I thought that was very interesting. She seemed to be talking to herself, and I can't figure out if Sister Alice actually thinks that she has these abilities, if that is something that she's maybe gotten to her head after, you know, years of abuse, or if has been conning, because her mom seems to be like truly in like the con of it all. She kind of says there's nothing above, below, or in between. It's just you and me. But something, I feel like Alice, something in her wants to believe that this is real. And it felt to me that she was asking Emily just as much as she was asking herself whether she was lying to her.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it seemed almost as much as Alice was giving her confessional to Emily.
Right.
Of, do you really think I can do this? What do you know about me? What do you really think I can do? And trying to find the gentlest way to explain to Emily that what she wants to happen probably isn't gonna happen, because Alice knows she can't make it happen. She can't bring Charlie back from the dead.
You think she knows that for sure?
The more that she has clashed with her mother, and I don't think, if it wasn't for the standoff in the radio station, which predates this conversation in this chapter, I think at that point, Alice is rattled enough that people are seeing through the illusions that she has cast.
Right.
And she is questioning not only her own faith, but her ability to maintain the illusion. And Emily, her last chance for what she thinks is going to be the life that she can get hinges on Alice's ability to make the illusion pay off. And Alice comes to her at a point where she is not feeling it. And she lays it out for Emily. And that's when Emily says to her, "Are you lying to me?" Because she is such an acolyte and needs this to work. That when we get to the resurrection and it goes the way most people would have expected it to go, that Emily's reaction is just as bad as Alice's. That the facade is completely shattered. And we see Emily wanting to just fall into the hole with that casket, that empty casket. And she just screaming, "I just want to be with my baby." She is checked out, done.
I wonder if the next episode, if Alice's mom actually manages to get the baby in front of Emily, I wonder if she is so far gone that she would buy into it, or if she would know that it isn't hers.
The thing is when we get to that point where they pull into that crowd and Birdie gets that baby, it took me 2 seconds to look at it and realize there's no way that's going to fly.
No, it looks completely different.
Yeah, it's a brown-haired, brown-eyed baby that would be replacing a blonde-haired, blue-eyed baby.
Yep.
That's not going to work. I think, and especially at that point, I think that's where Alice, that justifies her finally just going,
"I'm done."
She can't take it, and she runs.
Yeah. Where do you think she's heading to?
I have no idea. I think at that point, she is just trying to get away. That it pays off in some ways the reason of having the flashback to her as a girl at the beginning. With the weight of everything that's happened in this chapter, that she devolves a little bit and goes back to that girl who couldn't run away because her mother put her in a position where she wasn't able mm-hmm. to. And she just basically says, "Screw it," and just runs.
That's actually kind of powerful, I think, to have that at the beginning and the end, to frame the episode in that way. Mm.
It is. And again, it adds a little bit more context to why that flashback was there at the beginning of this one. There is one other character that I haven't touched on in this one, and that is Lupe.
Yup.
Lupe's not in this one for very long, but damn, does she leave a mark. one of the things that she's been doing in her back and forth little game with Perry is she keeps telling him, you know, at some point you're going to sell me your farm, because she owns the airport that's built around it.
That's right. And
after things go sideways in court, he goes back to the bar that is there at the airport to get a drink, and Lupe pulls him aside and says, I need to talk to you. And he's like, I'm not in a good mood. And she lays it out for him. You haven't paid your property taxes in 5 years. You know what happens to that? And then it clicks and he goes, oh, you didn't. And she goes, I did it 2 weeks ago. Now, if you have a property that is delinquent, the bank puts it up for sale. Whoever buys it, that offsets the bank's cost or the government's cost and a tax issue. So Lupe outbid everybody and she bought the farm. Literally bought the farm. And Perry, of course, is not happy about this. And Lupe is stone cold about it.
I'm going to take the bold stance of saying that I'm actually on Lupe's side of this. And that she has given him notice after notice after notice in the six episodes leading up to this point. And Perry didn't pay his property taxes for 5 years, and the house was going to be sold either way. And I don't think that she actually has anything to feel bad for, other than just the kind of regular empathy that it's tough for Perry.
Or that, I mean, it's her boyfriend, yeah, quote unquote, that she's kicking out. I think the kicking out is specifically what gets it for me. Like, he's going to have to find a new place to go. But if she had just bought the house and let him continue living there and he paid rent to her, I think that would have been better. Or at least if, you know, you want Lupe to come out looking better.
Well, and to James' point, when Perry understandably bites back at her about it and says, you know, you're a snake. She says flat out, I'm a businesswoman.
I believe that. I do believe that she meant no malicious intent and like nothing personally, that she was just doing what she had to do.
Right. And as James said, it's not like this came out of the blue. She has been telling him since day one, I'm going to buy the farm. Sell me the farm. And it was Perry's own stubbornness and his refusal to acknowledge the situation that led him there. And yes, not paying your property taxes for 5 years, that puts a kink in it. Granted, we're 3 years into the Great Depression. I don't know a whole lot of people who were paying much of anything as far as taxes back then.
Right.
But still, it's that, and that correlates also in the conversation afterwards with Drake as he is tending to his parents' gravesite, which again Lupe promised, you know, I'll leave them where they are. And Perry's just basically like, oh, shove off.
Right. It's actually pretty generous of her, though, if she's looking to build airstrips and stuff.
I agree.
It wouldn't take much for her to exhume them and make that part of the tarmac. No. And I think in some ways that was her trying to soften the blow as much as she could.
Absolutely.
I agree.
And we also see as he leaves that it didn't go the way she was hoping.
No.
But I'm pretty sure we're not seeing her again in season two.
I'll be disappointed if she doesn't come back.
Me too. I really liked her.
She has had, I think, relative to most other characters, a very low amount of screen time. But pretty much every scene that she's in is electric with her presence.
For a character who would never have made it into the 1950s version. They would have never put a character like Lupe in there, period.
Right.
Let alone having her be a potential love interest, especially, or just even a physical distraction for Perry the way she was early on in this series. There is a degree of genuine affection there, but Lupe understands what their dynamic is. Perry, I think, to an extent, romanticized it and also didn't want to acknowledge it, that he was just, he was a convenience in some ways.
I think I would like to see her not be totally done, because in some ways, though this is offset by her saying it wasn't personal, I'm just a businesswoman, that her point as a character was just too distract Perry. I would like to see her be something other than like a foil for Perry, but maybe that's all that that character is meant to be.
True. And we still, as of yet, we don't have the resolution on the case, so we don't know for sure if there's something that Perry can do once the case is over to maybe get the farm back if he really, really wants it. But again, as he explained to Drake, the only person who really cared about it was his dad, and his dad's been dead for 12 years.
Right.
So he's got to find a way to decide if that fight is really worth it or if it's better just to let it go. And we did skip over one part of this, in that what led Pete to make the decision to break it off with Perry was after he comes to him and explains what he found out in Colorado of the connection of Ennis to one of the two Poles who were involved in the kidnapping, and Eric Seidel, the church elder. All three of those men were involved, as I mentioned last week, in the Ludlow Coal Massacre in 1914. The three men worked for Colorado Fuel and Iron, who was the business side of it, against the strikers. And when he explains that Ennis was involved with the Poles, that was one thing. As soon as he mentions Seidel, we see Perry's face light up.
Well, the whole case at this point is unlocked by the revelation that there's a definitive connection between the church and the conspirators.
I did genuinely laugh when, on his way out, Pete says to him, he says, you know, hey, you look like a lawyer up there for a minute. And Perry's...
flips him off.
Screw you.
Incredible. I loved that moment.
There's such great little exchanges like that in this, which, again, plays to the chemistry of the characters that I just loved. The other aspect of this episode that I felt was really out of place was during the cross-examination with Baggerly on the stand, how it was suddenly cut off by two people getting into the courtroom and lobbing a smoke bomb into it. It was like, that came totally out of nowhere.
I agree. That was a very weird scene. It was the opening of that scene with Perry examining or cross-examining, whichever, Baggerly on the stand and starting to draw out the connection after earlier Hicks had said specifically that the church is in debt of just over $100,000. You know, surprise there. And Baggerly, as the main source of income, has cut off Seidel and said that I won't give you any more money. And that was back in September. And so Perry is very explicitly drawing these dots together. And it's a big moment, if not for the audience's understanding, definitely for the jury's understanding. And for that scene to be cut off in such a weird, unrelated way. Like, I'm not entirely sure who those people were supposed to be protesting. If they were protesting against Sister Alice or on behalf of Sister Alice and Emily, that wasn't really clear to me.
And I don't think it was intended to be. It was just, we need to throw a wrench in the works. We'll send one big burly guy in there with a blonde wig to look like Sister Alice. He'll say a bunch of stuff, and then somebody will throw a big Looney Tunes-style smoke bomb in there, and chaos will ensue. It was like, where the hell did that come from? And why put that in there now? You had us right on the edge of understanding the full length of this conspiracy, and it would have been even better to see Barnes trying to come back on that as more of his case is unraveling than to just throw a completely random chaotic element in there and find a weird way to end the scene and end that part of the episode.
Right. If you're going to do something to cut it off, do something that is somehow related to not only the plot, but also just kind of the tone of the episode and the show. It was just a really bizarre moment. And it's not dealt with anymore in the episode
right after
that moment. Like, I guess maybe if they come back next episode and are like, the final arguments will be in a sealed room with only the attorneys and the jury or something like that.
I don't think they'll do
guess
that.
It could have payoff, but that, yeah, that just doesn't seem likely to me.
Yeah, I think that was one where the writers just didn't really know how to end that scene. So it's, we'll just have somebody throw a smoke bomb.
Right, and for a group of writers who've been pretty sharp for most of the season, that's a little disappointing.
To be fair, with what they've been able to accomplish so far, that's one of the few real quirks I have against them. So all told, their batting average is still pretty good for this season. So
sure.
Built on that information about Seidel and Innes, we get the point where Innes and Seidel meet after Seidel gives Pete the slip. I had a feeling that it was going to play out the way they did. On the other, I was left asking the question, how many stabs does it take to truly whack a corrupt church elder? Because Innes goes to town on him.
And he's an old man, too, Seidel. It's not like it would take that much.
Innes, as we have seen, can strong arm like the best of them. He's not going Jason Voorhees and using a machete. He's using a stiletto, which isn't a big blade. And I'm not sadistic enough to do a count, but I'm willing to bet he got him more than 20 times.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, do you think he was trying to make it look like a robbery? I'm sure he went a little bit overzealous on the stabbing, but the stealing of the ring?
Yeah, that's my theory, is that he intentionally made it look kind of sloppy. And we see him take the ring, and he takes those train tickets back out that he had just handed him, and it looks to me, at least, like he's taking Seidel's wallet out of his coat pocket along with the tickets. So my theory there is that he's trying to make it look like a mugging gone wrong.
Mm.
And it's in the middle of nowhere on the road right next to the car. I guess that could definitely be true.
At this point, I'm not entirely sure how relevant it is, other than it just takes Seidel off the board and puts even more of a focus on Innes. You do bring up two good points, though, James, in because we know that the church was $100,000 in debt, and in Chapter 1, the money that was supposed to be there wasn't there. The suitcase was empty. So who ultimately got the money? Did Innes get it? Or because he's working with Seidel, did the church get it? That is still up in the air. We don't know.
Right. We'll have to see. And it also made me wonder, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it was so long ago, but Innes is the one who shot the other three.
Yes.
So it made me wonder if Seidel knows that or not, because...
Right, like why would he trust
him? Right, like if he knows that Innes killed the other three, unless Innes did that on Seidel's orders, in which case that would suggest that probably the church ultimately got the money. But we've seen no indication so far that the church got the money. They still seem to be in trouble. And so that whole thing is kind of a mess, and we'll have to see how they wrap that up.
The one thing that we do get in this exchange is we finally get confirmation that Seidel and Innes both had a hand in the death of Charlie Dodson.
Right.
Because Seidel even says what we did to that kid was just, it was an unforeseen element we had to deal with.
Right.
And Drake, stepping in for Pete, brings us the other half of that as he goes out to the motel and finds out that that's where they took Charlie after they kidnapped him. And we see him a little bit at the beginning because he's... speakeasy is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, oh, because we're still in Prohibition.
Yes.
Which I forget a lot.
Yeah, Prohibition goes away, I believe, the following year, if I remember my history right.
I think you're right.
Paul is able to butter up his coworker to get the commander's classified file to get more information, which leads him out to the motel. And I loved the exchange with the motel owner where Paul trying to get the information he needs and the motel owner, who's an older white female, is just talking down at him the whole time. And he is well past the point where he gives a damn about any of that. He is not going to take it anymore.
I love Paul, and something that I think will be really interesting and important for you is to have a person of color on the podcast to talk about that through line with Paul Drake, because, you know, there are parts of that story that none of us but a person of color can understand, and they will bring a perspective that is truly important and enlightening.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I would genuinely love, and I've been trying to all season, because I would very much, just as I wanted to have you on, Taylor, I would love to get that aspect of it, because again, I can only go so far with what I know.
Right.
And I definitely would like to have that, if not by the end of this season. Absolutely, I would like to have somebody who can give that perspective in season two, if we can go that way.
Especially since Paul Drake is becoming, I think, getting ready to become a much bigger character.
Yes, and in the 50s show, he is the investigator for Perry. And in the 50s show, he was a white guy with a shock of white hair. He looked like Race Bannon from Johnny Quest, to be perfectly honest with you. But that Earl Stanley Gardner, the creator of Perry Mason, left Paul Drake very nebulous in who he was, and that the writers chose to make him an African-American man was, to still to me, one of the smartest decisions they made in bringing this show back.
Right.
Because it does. It opens up just as many layers of subtext and context for this show as we did with having Della and Ham and Hazel and the other LGBTQ plus characters we had.
Exactly. I mean, like I said before, the show is full of white men, but I like that they do make a serious effort to include people of color and, you know, LGBTQ plus people. My only other thought in that line is with the brothel. I'm not sure if that's what it's called in this show, but...
Yep, it was.
Those women are not, obviously, they're treated with a great deal of racism. Just in as much as the brothel exists, like, that already is, you know, not great. And so I think that is an interesting through line, too. I don't think we're going to get a lot more of it, but I was interested in it. And I hope that they pursue some kind of justice for the woman that I think, we had this debate, James and I did, whether Ennis killed that woman or whether he provided her with, like, too much dope, or if it was laced dope, because we think that, like, her overdose, that is way too coincidental for it not to be, you know, done by Ennis in some way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, especially given what we know about Ennis's character.
Right.
And that he has zero regard for pretty much anybody who can compromise his position. I don't think it would be unlikely at all that he had a hand in her dying. But what I wasn't anticipating was the connection between her and the death of Charlie Dodson, that we find out it wasn't anything more malevolent than they were trying to calm a upset child by having a woman there to nurse him.
Right.
The problem was is that they brought in someone who was a heroin junkie to do it, and that was what led to his death.
Yeah, it's all together, like, really sad.
It was. Although there was a great moment of levity that cut right through that, where Perry goes to the morgue and talks with Virgil to get the information about that woman, where Virgil, if this one turns up in a bowling alley wearing a party hat, I'm going to pry open your skull with a claw hammer. That, watching it again, I was laughing for a good 10 minutes about that. Yeah, go ahead. I'll just sit here, take a swing. Even he concedes that he earned that after leaving George's corpse in a sand trap. To get that little payoff was worth it. And then getting the additional facts that came up about afterwards was even better. So I do like how they are tying up as many different threads as they can. But as we got to bring this one into land for this week, we now have to figure out what is going to be happening in the final chapter. And now, to be fair, you don't write stories like this to see somebody like Perry Mason fall on his face.
Right.
I would expect not.
We can all concede the fact Perry is going to find a way to get Emily Dodson off this murder charge and bring some measure of justice for her and, by extent, for him. That said, I'll leave it to both of you. What do you expect to see, and what would you like to see in Chapter 8?
Let's see. What I would like to see? I mean, I love... what I've heard of the previous show is that it was a big, like, high-stress courtroom scenes that, you know, were really vindicating. And so I'm expecting a couple of those for Perry to just, like, you know, like, snap and drop some bombs on the jury. I don't know. You know how lawyers do, be like a hotshot lawyer. We've agreed we expect that to happen. I'm just kind of intrigued to see what happens with Sister Alice at this point, where she goes for the next hour, because it seems like her part to play is over and that the quote-unquote resurrection of Charlie Dodson has happened. But, you know, she runs off, and I really want to follow her story.
Yeah, I agree. I'm interested to see if the church is just supposed to be limited to this season, or if that's something going forward. In that scene between Della and Ham, he mentions that, you know, he's interested in digging more into the church and finding some sort of scandal in there. And I'm not sure if that was hinting at just the collaboration between the church and the kidnappers that'll be resolved next episode, or if that is hinting at perhaps a larger investigation that either Della or Ham might undertake next season.
I'm with you guys. I would like to see how Sister Alice's story will ultimately play out. I think that the church, as kind of the silent villain in this first season, I'm pretty sure that there will be story elements put in place that completely obliterates it. But that does leave us figuring out what is she going to do, who is she going to be, where is she going to go. Having an actor of the caliber of Tatiana Maslany, being able to bring her back for multiple seasons, I don't know how tenable that is for the producers.
She's so good. She's so good.
I mean, if they could find a way to bring her back even for a one-shot next season, sign me up.
Yeah.
You know, I watched all of Orphan Black. I am fully on board with her and know what her full capability is as an actor, and she's great.
I think all the performances have actually been pretty good.
There hasn't been one that's really been out of step for me. And that, again, plays to the smartness of getting good, solid character-based actors in here. And to think that this was originally going to be a Robert Downey Jr.-led vehicle. Granted, he's an executive producer.
Yeah, unbelievable, right.
But I still cannot see him being Perry with this cast. They would have needed to find bigger people to bring around him. And I don't... Having Matthew Reese as Perry, it works for me. Especially in this episode where we see him cleaned up in the dark suit, granted with a little bit of garbage stain on it, and really coming into his own. And I saw and if you watched this episode, of course, they have the trailer for Chapter 8 at the end, and we see him really ramping it up. And I want to see Perry off the hook a little bit.
Absolutely. And I'm just really interested in seeing if they're going to spend the entire hour wrapping up this plot and just leave us there, or if they're looking to set up elements for season 2. I just don't know what their plan is for the season finale, and I'm excited to find out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are 7 hours down. We have one more to go. But James Farner, Taylor Hickney, this has been great. I hope we get to do this again. If not for Chapter 8, then when season two comes around. But thank you very much for joining.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was so much fun.
So I will be back to put a cap on season one of Perry Mason next week. But until then, I'm your host, Devin Higgins. It's been great, everybody. I will talk to you then. Bye.